The bibliography, I wanted you to buy the synopsis because this is an excellent tool, and I would say it is indispensable for study of the exegesis of the Gospels. Now, I think you have, most of you have seen this, if not you possess it, and I hope you know what I'm talking about. It prints the UBS text and the RSV text. Now, if you're wondering what version it's used, it's the RSV. Not the best text, but there's nothing we can do about it. Their format is excellent. I have seen Huck, H-U-C-K. Have you come across that? This is the synopsis that actually displays Huck's synopsis in Greek. A.T. Robertson also has a synopsis. But of all the available Gospel Harmony, this is the best. Because not only does it give you the parallel arrangement, but it will split up the paragraph so that you can run your eye across horizontally and find similar wordings. Now, as you know, to make a synopsis, you have to interpret the Gospels, and sometimes your opinion may be subjective to a certain extent. They have tried to overcome that by putting in small print passages which may or may not fit into that particular slot. So it actually fulfills many functions. What I like too is that it has notes below. The textual criticism is given, as well as quotations from the Old Testament. So you don't really have to have your other UBS text with you. Okay, now, I want to say something about the UBS text which is being passed around. And incidentally, the Greek text used in the synopsis is the same as that over there. I'm using the second edition.
Oh, okay, but the one we have, that's the third.
Yes, but it's just it's a better edition actually. Because mine is an older one. They keep on improving this. You know that you realize, don't you, that the UBS has the Greek text and computerized, so that from time to time new findings are accounted for. The text is changed, and the computer at Stuttgart will bring up a new edition. Okay, but the changes are usually not that many, because they have actually come to a situation where I would say we are 99% sure of the text we are using. Okay, but the good thing is that there's an ongoing work here using modern technology. Now, this UBS text has become very popular. Before that, most people were using the British and Foreign Bible Society edition, which is a blue edition. Or, if you were not using that, you probably would be using the Nestle edition. Not pronounced Nestle, but Nestle. The Nestle edition is still very serviceable. There are some problems with this edition, though. The reviews of this, since its publication, has shown that some of the decisions that were arrived at may have to be revised. UBS. The whole system. If you look at the textual material at the bottom, you see that they have given only those readings that merited a certain letter, A, B, C, D, and so forth. Okay. Now, the Nestle edition uses Latin abbreviations. It's actually not easy to understand that. But the Nestle edition is fuller. This one gives only those textual critical material that is relevant to the edition. But the good thing about this edition is that it has textual commentary. Have you seen that? That goes with it. The problem lies mainly with the C category readings in the UBS, which indicates there's considerable doubt. They have chosen the reading despite considerable doubt. And scholars who have worked through this text have found that the C category should actually be broken into two sections and so forth. So there's a lot of criticism. But I like this text because it has English headings, subheadings, and it's easy on the eyes. It's a beautiful text, actually. And also there helps to go with it. You know, you can have the dictionary and the exegesis, the grammar. Most of the Greek New Testaments use the principle of the eclectic text. Now, are you familiar with the position of Trinitarian Bible Society, which says that the Textus Receptus is the inspired text, and that we should base all new editions, new translations on the Textus Receptus? Now, scholars have been too quick to jettison the Textus Receptus. There's some good work emanating from Kampen University in Holland, as well as, surprisingly, a few. I'm thinking particularly of Gunther Zunz, Z-U-N-T-Z, who has a book entitled The Text of the Epistles, in which, surprisingly, he comes out for the Textus Receptus, on a number of points. And people are beginning to realize that perhaps we should not be too quick to accept the eclectic text. In other words, Aleph and B, are you familiar with these two? Vaticanus and Sinaiticus. Do not altogether define what is the correct reading. Sometimes Aleph and B together could be wrong. The Proto-Alexandrian text type sometimes is inferior to the Koine or Byzantine text type. So we should always let a passage speak for itself rather than apply woodenly the rule of Aleph and B as determining the right reading. Yes, okay, now this term means that scholars have no longer used the Aleph and B method, which was the Westcott and Hort method. And most of the editions that use that are put out now look at the Greek text from the standpoint of text types. Now, the eclectic text means that the correct reading is chosen from any number of text types. Okay, it's a refusal to allow Aleph and B to dictate the what is the correct text type. But in practice, most of the time, the eclectic textual principle uses Aleph and B. Okay? But what I'm trying to say is that don't rule out of court any Koine text type. On occasion, we may have to say that it is perhaps the best reading. So, I would continue using it, but just be careful.
There is an eclectic text.
Oh, yes. In fact, you find that has won the day for most people. What I'm trying to say is that maybe there is more to the Textus Receptus than we think that there should be. Lexicons. I don't know what lexicons you use, but Arnon Gingrich is an excellent lexicon because it maps out the possible meanings of a word in the light of its etymology, and particularly in the light of its usage in vernacular coining. You notice that the title of Arnon Gingrich says that it is a lexicon of the New Testament and other early Christian literature. Now, we cannot underline too much the importance of this other early Christian literature, because very often the meaning of a word is determined by its usage in that sense. Be careful, though, how you use Arnon Gingrich. There are Bible references in Arnon Gingrich, linked up with a different meaning, but don't regard the decision of Arnon Gingrich as sacrosanct. The actual sense of the word still has to be shown in its interplay with the context, and sometimes it is necessary for you to disagree with Arnon Gingrich. Okay? You do not have to be an expert grammarian to claim the right to disagree. But choose a meaning that you feel that is demanded by the context, no matter what the lexicon says. But I still find Arnon Gingrich the best.
The Bauer Arnon Gingrich is just a revision.
Oh, yes.
That's right. Just saying it's still be true.
Sure.
How can you better utilize these early Christian references? There's so many references there. You just read over them and you get to the definition, and it seems like you might as well not even have it because you don't use them.
Most of the time when I'm translating, I don't do that kind of close work. I just choose the decision of the lexicographers. But when I'm dealing with a controversial point, or when I'm doing a deep study on one word, then I would read thoroughly. And incidentally, when I use my Arnon Gingrich, I underline it. I find that I'm faced with a mess of print. And having underlined something which I had noticed that was significant, I find it helpful when I come back to that word, because it saves me a great deal of time. It stands out really clearly to me. I like the bibliographic materials in Arnon Gingrich as well. They're helpful. Sometimes I use Thayer. I don't know how many of you have Thayer. I find the synonyms better treated in Thayer than in Arnon Gingrich. When you're using the Septuagint, it's better to use Suter's lexicon if you have Suter, Alexander Suter. But you really don't need Suter, because Arnon Gingrich would suffice.
That's good with the Septuagint, you say?
Yes. Brecher and Nidus, Translator's Handbook. This is a useful tool for those who wish to render the New Testament into Greek. From Greek, rather, into some vernacular language. Now, Brecher and Nider use the principle of transformational linguistics. I don't know whether you are familiar with this term. Transformational linguistics. That is to say, they see the need quite often to take a certain expression in the Greek, okay, which cannot be translated literally into the receptor language. In our case, it is English. We are translating from Greek into English. So what do? Well, we may have to do some back transformation, work back to the Aramaic and see what it says. Okay. And once we have gotten that basic sense, then we work forward into the receptor language. So the resultant translation in English would have no syntactical correspondence with the Greek word. Like, for instance, the way we translated this morning, let him really hear, from hearing, let him hear. We were doing a little bit of transformational linguistics. Yeah. Okay? It is sometimes necessary to do that. And Brecher and Nidus has to do that because they are reaching for clarity in the receptor language, not for faithfulness as such. Now, I better define what I mean by faithfulness, because we often hear this term used in a very loose sense. The authorized version is the most faithful version. You hear that phrase? A translation which is a faithful one would have to leave vague what the original intends to leave vague. And I would say most of the modern translations are not faithful in that sense. That extends the meaning into some area which may have everything to say for it in terms of clarity and fluency, but may not be the best translation, because the original speaker may have intended the meaning to be vague so that it could go either way. For instance, let's take the genitive. We try to define whether something is objective or subjective. Perhaps the biblical writer intended it to be either subjective or objective. Let me give you a classic example. Dikaiosune theou. The righteousness of God in Romans. Now, you know the debate whether it should be objective genitive, which means righteousness conforming to some standard which God has dictated, which he wanted to see in men, which would have a forensic meaning here, or whether righteousness which is imparted by God. Well, basically what Luther did in his struggle for trying to find meaning here was that he saw the righteousness of God as having an objective sense. It was a very hard standard which God has set for man, and man cannot reach that standard. He constantly fails, he sins. He never arrives at that point, and God therefore has to inflict punishment. And it was only when he saw that it was that the righteousness of God is something which is out of God's mercy and love, in which God not only has these standards but makes it possible for men to become righteous. Now the subjective idea that Luther began to understand more the message of Romans. Now I know there's more to it than just this simple explanation, but sometimes the original may intend to leave the sense vague enough so that both ideas could be present, but not in one and the same context. I need to say this because if you look at all the occurrences of this phrase in Romans, you find that in some cases the context would require an objective meaning, objective genitive meaning. In some cases it would require a subjective genitive meaning. So that to spell out the whole concept, you've got to include both ideas. So a faithful translation would have to recognize that kind of thing, you see. So when we are trying to translate something, and this has to do with Brescia and Nider now, sometimes when we reach for clarity, we have already become tendential in our work. We do not become faithful in that sense. I find the notes, the exegetical notes in Brecher and Nider, on the rather elementary side. They're useful. I have occasionally discovered an interesting idea here and there, but they do not go deeply enough to make exegesis, deep exegesis possible. I like the discussion on the vernacular translations. It's really interesting to see how scripture can be rendered into the various languages. Some of them I've never heard of before. Okay. Kaiser and Kimmel, exegetical method. This is a translation of the German, and is Einführung in die Exegesis Methoden. Introduction to the exegetical method. It is a liberal work, and it deals with both Old Testament and New Testament exegesis. It's a slender paperback volume. You may find it helpful. But I would prefer, if I have limited means, the next book, which is Kaiser's, Walter Kaiser's Exegetical Theology. This is a book which supplies a very much needed aspect. Kaiser aims at bridging, I'll pass this around, the gap between the study of the biblical text, which is conducted in seminaries, Hebrew and Greek, and the actual delivery of messages. He feels that we often short-circuit the process simply for lack of time, and students come to a point where they are introduced into the art of exegesis. They do not have enough confidence in it. They don't feel comfortable, you know, in working through the text, and then it stops there, and they're left to their own devices. So Kaiser shows how to bridge that gap, and he has some helpful syntactical analysis of the Greek text, how you can derive sermon outlines in an expository fashion from a given text without imposing an artificial framework onto the text. Marshall's interlinear. When I was at Faith, I was told never use an interlinear. I don't know whether you still said yeah, at Biblical. But I enjoy my interlinear. I have to say that. Because I move faster with it. I find I can get more done. It is good when you are a student not to be not to depend too much on Kubo or interlinears or some of these texts. But once you are beyond that stage, you know, any means to get you working with as much as possible of the biblical text would help. What I like about this is that it is a very scholarly interlinear edition, not some of the, if I may say, junk work that is put out. It is highly recommended by J.B. Phillips, and it has the King James Version in the column here. I don't like interlinears that don't allow me to see the English text by itself. And since my church uses King James, I find that I can virtually use this all the time. And for that matter, I ought to introduce you to an Old Testament interlinear. The name escapes me. It's a two-volume work, which you ought really to have. Between J. Green. I'm not. I have to see it before I know what it is. I see. Yes. Well, I'll pass this around for you to take a look. Now, I've talked about this to several of you already. There are many Greek grammars today. When I was at Regent, a student told me, showed me a book that he used at Ohio State University. He had Greek then. New Testament Greek Without Tears. And I really enjoyed it. It had cartoons. Have you ever tried to... Yes. I don't know what it is. It's not Metzger. Well, I don't know, but I was interested in the cartoons anyway. I found it confusing to use because you have to understand what the cartoon is trying to say first. And then after that, you see it's rather corny. It has no direct relevance. But I would say of all the grammars that I've been exposed to, I've enjoyed this most. I ought to talk about this in conjunction with this, actually. John Wenham's Elements of New Testament Greek. Now, this is the text in Britain today. Most universities and schools use this. It needs some revision, but what I like about this is the inductive approach. you are exposed to New Testament Greek. Many of the examples used actual sentences from the New Testament. It's very clear, and there's a key that goes with it, giving all the answers to the sentences. Maybe I can pass it this way. Yes. Now, this book is meant to be the elementary textbook for this one, which is the second textbook. C.F.B. Moore was the Lady Margaret Professor at Cambridge, which has a long tradition for excellence in literary and linguistic studies in New Testament. And over many years, he has gathered together in his study of the Greek Testament a good insight into not only the regular uses of words, but also to the exceptional uses. Now, I found in going through Dana and Menti, and I had HPV Nunn, I had Harold Greenlee's grammar, that at a certain point I have to unlearn what I learned on those, because certain things which were rules actually didn't apply. I found very little that I have to unlearn from studying Moore. Now, he is not easy to understand. You have to read him many times. But I find that he has compressed everything well, and I like especially the biblical index, which keys in to all that he's been trying to say. Okay?
Is that still in print?
Oh, yes. It's in print. You can buy it. I would really prefer that.
Complete enough? Is it elementary and complete enough to be used for advanced reading?
Well, shall I put it this way? I'm still using it. Having taught it for 11 years, I find there are still things which I'm still learning from it.
Well, I'm not denying that.
I'm saying that.
The other way, is it elementary enough? Does it, in fact?
Oh, I see. The other way.
Basics, rather than some of the more advanced points and advanced points and advanced reading.
No, I think it would be, if a student goes from first year into rapid reading and then into advanced Greek, then this would be useful. I should think that if a person wants something that is complete and straightforward, easy to understand, Benjamin Chapman's summary that I was speaking of will do. If you can combine the use of this with that, it should be excellent. Okay. Theron's Evidence of Tradition. Theron was a Princeton professor, and this is highly recommended because it uses primary sources in the original languages. What I like about this is, for instance, if I'm dealing with a Papias tradition, I would like to see the original. And sometimes it is not easy to find the fathers, you know, quoted in the original. Or if you are reading Tacitus or Suetonius, what they have to say about Christ, he gives the original and the translation of it on the opposite page. There is another text called Zerwick's Biblical Greek. Now, this is a very popular Greek text on the continent. There are paragraph headings. There's a very careful discussion on the syntax. I have quite a number of Greek grammars, and I found that from my own experience, most of the time when I want to understand some point of grammar, I would turn to C.F.D. Moore, Alien Book, and I would stop there. But if Moore does not satisfy me, he has not explained further, I would either go to A.T. Robertson for a fuller treatment, or to Blas de Bruyne, or to Zerwick, Biblical Greek. Okay? Now, the good thing about Zoic is that it is keyed to these two books, two-volume books, Zoic Grosvenor, A Grammatical Analysis of New Testament, of the Greek New Testament. Now, if I had to choose between Kubo and this, some of you may know Kubo, huh? I would much prefer this. Now, what does this do? I'll pass this around. This is just a second edition. I mean, second volume. It takes you verse by verse. And if you're doing Mark, all you need to do is just keep the page of Mark open. And as you translate, he will bring out the... he will identify the tense, the mood of a difficult word. He will tell you a significant point of grammar. Your annotations would almost all be here. And you can just expand from here. Now, on certain points, he doesn't elaborate further. He just gives a section in the biblical Greek. So this is the grammar that is key to this grammatical analysis.
When you look at things like this, if you depend wholly on something like this, though, I get the idea that you're just doing the lazy man's way. Is that right, or is it... Is it just when you don't have the time, is it better to do the work? You know what I'm asking?
Yes. No, it's much better for you to do your own work, but I think that it is just a matter of pride to say that, well, I'll do my own work, I don't need any help. What I would like to do is, when I approach the text, I will do my own work first, as much as I can, or time allows. Then I would then turn to commentaries. Usually I would turn to Zoic Grosvenor and see what they have to say. And then I would turn to the commentaries to amplify further what they have to say. So in the end, I feel I have really covered the significant points in the passage, because one of the annoying things at this stage for you is that you know that there are significant things, but you just don't see them. You are not at the stage where you have your eye trained enough to catch those points. So if you use this as a matter of habit, the grammatical analysis, you will begin to see some pattern emerging, and very soon you can put it aside and begin to see for yourself some of those points.
Are these Roman Catholic?
Yes. Well, it is a Roman Catholic work from the Pontifical Biblical Institute, but you know, the lady who is connected with it, Mary Grosvenor, was a missionary daughter from China, and I don't know how she got connected with the Vatican, but she has spent many years working on these two. On several points, I disagree with this. For instance, we were working through John, the prologue of John. And I see that some of the liberalism of the authors have crept into the grammatical analysis. But you learn to take what you can agree with and just ignore the things that you can't accept. Okay?